Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name's Roland Clark, and I'm here today on the New Books Network talking to Bruce O'Neill, who's an Associate Professor of Anthropology at St. Louis University. This is Bruce's second book. The first was called The Space of Boredom, Homelessness in the Slowing Global Order. And he has a long-standing interest in urban anthropology, post-socialism, consumption, and material culture. Bruce, this is a book about all the underground spaces in the city of Bucharest, the metro system, basement apartments, nightclubs, parking garages, and bomb shelters. What first got you interested in the underground?
It's a great question, Roland. And let me just first say how grateful I am to be here. I'm super excited to have this conversation and to get to talk a little bit about the book. And I guess, I'll really just take it from the top here. The interest in this book really came out of the end of the first book that you mentioned, The Space of Boredom, which was interested in unhoused populations in Bucharest. When I was wrapping up the fieldwork on that first book, I became aware of an underground squatter settlement near the Gara de Nord railway station, the main railway station in Bucharest. And I was also becoming aware that there were, I was having some close contacts who were squatting in otherwise abandoned buildings near the Gara de Nord station. And I noted that both of these populations were really making use of the metro station as a place to hang out, certainly during bad weather, as a place to earn money working odd jobs for kiosk workers, and as a place to spend money, to shop in these kiosks. And so I became interested in this vision of the underground. And so when the first book ended, I turned my attention to the underground in 2015. And it was at that moment that this longstanding squatter settlement was closed by a police action. It had been in existence for some 20 years, and it was forcibly shut down in the name of health and safety. And so, my interest in the underground maintained, but as I moved forward, I recognized that this moment of closing down this squatter settlement was the beginning of a larger process of reimagining the underground, of gentrifying the underground, of reconceiving what the underground could be, who it could be for, in a moment where Bucharest was really developing rapidly. So I had this sort of longstanding interest in the underground, but the project itself unfolded in ways that I could never have predicted when I first got started.
And one of the main arguments in the book is that people relate to the underground differently compared to the way they relate to above ground. And mm-hmm. You make this point by talking about the two McDonald's restaurants in Union Square in Bucharest, or Piazza Uniri. Mm-hmm. The one above ground is trendy and comfortable and plays relaxed music. And the one underground is sparse and uncomfortable and plays fast, upbeat music. Why are the two restaurants so different when they're one's on top of the other one?
It's a great question. So as the underground begins to become more significant to the city, there's this push to reimagine what the underground is going to be. There are some basic questions that have to get answered, like who is going to be underground? Who is underground? What are they going to feel comfortable doing underground? What possibly could we convince people to spend their time underground? And there weren't great immediate answers as the project was getting started. This was sort of fresh terrain or unsettled terrain, thinking through these projects. And so I became very interested in, the McDonald's Corporation, which had these two restaurants located, one atop of the other in central Bucharest and its Union Square. And for me, this became a really interesting case study for beginning to think about the way the underground is being imagined, like who it's for and what it's done there, what is to be done down there. And so, yeah, you have these two restaurants, one located on top of the other. Ostensibly, they're the same thing. They're McDonald's restaurants. But they are staged or designed very differently and imagined for having very different populations. And so as I worked with McDonald's managers, both like at the restaurant level, but also at the corporate level, and thinking about design and strategy, there's a really firm belief that there were two different kinds of populations moving through the city, one that was above ground and one that was below ground. with class being a major distinction. And here, the McDonald's corporation is thinking about class in terms of purchasing power and nothing fancier than that or more intricate than that. And so the idea is that, you know, the McDonald's restaurant below is for a working class or lower middle class population, while the restaurant above was imagined as being for a more elite clientele. And, you know, this was spelled out in pretty concrete and direct terms, where it's like lawyers, businessmen, their families are above ground. And meanwhile, it's, you know, back office workers who are rushing below ground. And so with these two, with very different imagined populations, I was able to trace the way McDonald's designs their restaurants to cater to these two very different types of experiences, or produce these two very different types of experiences. And as you say, the, you know, the one up top not only looks differently, but works differently. It's designed to get people to really settle in, to spend, you know, ideally all afternoon in the McCafe, to make one purchase and then subsequent purchases. While the one down below for the, you know, quote unquote poorer population is, you know, intentionally designed to be less comfortable. It's designed for people to grab and go. The assumption is that it's workers who need to eat at their desk. They're not leisurely taking meetings. There are a lot of assumptions kind of built into both stores about how the two populations are working. And so for me, I start the book in that way because it really sets a tone and tenor for the way that the underground is being imagined in relation to the above ground. The underground as an extension of the city above, but an extension designed for a very particular population segment.
And you also make the point that running a business in a metro station is really quite difficult. What sorts of businesses do well underground, and why can't businesses like a grocery store survive down there?
Yeah. So let me think. Let me take a step back. In terms of thinking about, you know, what the underground could be and what its potentials are, corporations have a lot of excitement about the underground, and certainly the Bucharest underground in particular. You know, on any given day, some 600,000 people use the Bucharest Metro, and with new lines being planned, I think the estimation is to go north of 800,000 riders a day. And so with that kind of foot traffic, there is, you know, a lot of excitement about the kind of kiosks or businesses that could exist underground. And recognizable brands were interested in setting up shop. So for me, as I turn my attention towards these sort of metro kiosks and the kinds of businesses that take shape there, I was really interested in pursuing, again, like, what makes the underground distinctive in relationship to the city above? Well, there's wonderful consumer traffic underground, the kind that's going to draw the attention of a Carrefour or a Mega Image or a major retailer like that. The underground is a fixed kind of space. It's very hard to build the underground out. I mean, it's excavated out of earth and rock. And so the dimensions of the metro system, of passageways, are fixed. They were fixed during the socialist era, when this kind of consumerism was never imagined as part of commuting or a commuting experience. And so these kiosks were, you know, carved out of corners of metro stations or along the side walls of passageways, and they weren't particularly generous spaces. Certainly lucrative, giving the foot traffic, the pretty tight quarters. And so it required a certain kind of entrepreneurship to be able to work down there. You know, to take Carrefour as a case in point, Carrefour doesn't know what to do with, you know, 15 square meters. But an entrepreneur who can work in a smaller footprint can certainly thrive and make good money down there. And so thinking about, you know, that kind of question, again, I'm just really interested in trying to figure out who is thriving underground, why are they thriving underground, and, you know, how are they imagining the underground relating to the city above? And these kind of commercial questions really allow for some clarity in that tension.
And those chapters almost read like an MBA project, in terms of they really talk through really effectively how to run a business with certain constraints. But so people have coffee down there. People go shopping down there. But people also live down there. And you talk about how property owners in Bucharest, they're increasingly transforming their basements into apartments and renting them out. They're renting them to people who want to live in the city but can't afford more expensive places. What are the challenges involved for a landlord in renting out a basement apartment?
Sure. I mean, thinking about the book and one of the challenges, I was, you know, interested in the way that the city is extending underground, or urban life is extending underground. And so the ambitions of the book are to move beyond the metro system. Like, there's an element that I'm really interested in the metro because it was so dynamic in terms of transportation, in terms of its commercialization, and things of that nature. But I was also interested in other kinds of underground spaces. And here we can think about the way, you know, Bucharest has historically and more recently developed downward. And so I'm going to step way back on this, Roland, but I'll answer your question, I promise. You know, getting into the particularities of Bucharest, it didn't develop with a clearly defined city center and with medieval walls. It kind of developed through a series of trading posts with orchards and vineyards nearby. And a lot of the villas in central Bucharest have these really generous cellars as part of their buildings. And they were designed to hold wine and brandy or suica. And they had like a functional use for food preparation. Fast forward to our present era, these very generous spaces, these very generous cellars begin to get reimagined as property value, real estate values are beginning to rise, as the cost of living is beginning to rise, as the kind of pressures to be really efficient with the use of space in central Bucharest intensify. And so thinking about central Bucharest and the kind of villas that are there, there became this tendency in the teens to renovate cellars into rentable units for all the reasons of added income, for the reasons of added income. And so thinking about the renovation of these cellars, they were typically, you know, pretty quickly flipped. They're generous spaces. They hold their temperatures really well. They're very comfortable in the winter. They're very comfortable in the summer. And with not much investment, they can be rented out to a variety of college students, to early career workers, to cultural workers. There's a whole market for it. And so I was interested in the emergence of this market and the kinds of excitement that the market provided for people who are trying to live in central Bucharest and are feeling like they're being priced out. And so as I turned my attention to these basement level apartments, I wanted to toggle between the people who are renting them and the people who are developing them and renting them out. And so for, you know, people who are turning to the underground as landlords, there's a kind of excitement there, the ability to generate something like an extra income every month. And there's great potential there. But, you know, there's all of the drawbacks, as people were quick to explain to me, you know, all of the drawbacks of renting out a unit and having college students or 20-somethings who are making noise in your basement. They're utilizing the washing machine in your ground floor. You know, you definitely have these kind of strangers who are becoming entangled into your life. And so, yeah, in the chapter, I was really interested in the kind of potentialities and pitfalls of being able to earn extra money, but also suddenly having to negotiate relationships that you would rather do without.
So why would someone want to live in a place like that? Like, why would someone want to rent an underground apartment?
Yeah, for sure. So for the landlords, the upshot is to be able to live in a villa as opposed to an apartment block, to be able to live in central Bucharest as opposed to spinning out into an outer neighborhood. And for those who are actually renting the underground flat or apartment, the interest is similarly in order to be like in central Bucharest. So thinking about having ready at hand the jewels of the city, whether it's the university, whether it's the cultural institutions, whether it's the restaurants and cafes, the underground held out the possibility of living at the center of it all, in the middle of it all, so to speak. And so for a certain kind of we'll say young worker, but also cultural worker. If you think about somebody who might be in the fields of higher education or in museums, who have advanced degrees, who understand themselves as having high cultural capital, but maybe not a high earning salary, the underground opened up very affordable ways to live in the part of town that has a feeling of being, having notoriety affixed to it.
Somewhere else with notoriety is nightclubs that thrive underground. What attracted business owners in Bucharest's old town to set up nightclubs in basements?
Yeah, it's in here, it's really about flipping the historic underground of Bucharest. And so, this happened again in the early teens. It was a private sector initiative to develop a nightlife district in Bucharest. And what, I think is really distinctive about this nighttime district is that it really developed from the underground upwards. And the selling point for the underground was that, again, it was these kind of cavernous cellars that have a history of storing wine and brandy, things of that nature. And they were just cavernous spaces with open floor plans. They had brick walls and at times arched roofs. There was a kind of aesthetic beauty already to these underground spaces, and with a very minimum of lighting and throwing some tables down there with very little startup cash, it would be possible to set up a nightclub. The sturdiness of the underground, the ability to flip it pretty inexpensively, the ability to fit a lot of, we'll say, revelers on Friday and Saturday night, made it very appealing, certainly in comparison to the structures above these cellars, which had been neglected for several decades, certainly in the final decade of socialism. And, much of the neighborhoods above ground extensions were in a state of various disrepair. They would have required large loans in order to make them inhabitable as a business. And so, this kind of distinctiveness of the underground, the way that it took shape distinctively from the city above ground, made it this kind of ideal, intuitive place to set up a nightlife district.
And as the reader, I'm reading this book and the story of the nightclubs is going really well, and then suddenly in 2015, it all stops. What changed in 2015 that made it difficult or impossible to run nightclubs underground after that?
Yeah, things were going very well. Business is booming, on the internet and on blogs. Bucharest is getting a reputation as the new Prague. It's a nightlife destination. The plan seems to be working. Up until it didn't, there was a grisly fire at a nightclub that occurred at the Club Collective. There's a documentary that came out about it in the last few years. And the fire exposed, again, the kind of the particularities, the drawbacks, the limitations of operating underground. The short story is that pyrotechnics were used during a concert. The pyrotechnics caught insulation on fire. The underground lit up. A fire took shape underground. And it was very hard to clear the space. Exits had been illegally blocked or locked. There wasn't clear egress. And I think north of 100 people lost their lives in the incident. And so in the aftermath of the act of the tragedy, there is a kind of reckoning of thinking about, does it make sense to have these kinds of clubs underground? There is more serious conversation about what health and safety looks like, what kind of egresses are necessary, and the kind of like practicalities and safety began to layer on in ways that changed the economics of these clubs pretty drastically. Some of them are still open, but many of them have since shuttered. My expectation is that the spaces will be reimagined again at some point.
Another underground space that gets reimagined is parking garages, because Bucharest got this massive parking problem, and so the city council starts trying to build these underground parking garages. But then you point out that most of them aren't being used. So people are happy to party there. They're happy to shop underground. They're happy to live underground. Why won't they park their cars underground?
The parking situation in Bucharest is really, really outlandish. So there's, you know, again, just to take a step back, and this is common of a lot of formerly socialist countries in Eastern Europe, with the rise of middle classes, with the rise of consumer culture, there's an uptick in automobility that was impossible to predict in the socialist era. So, you know, thinking about how the Bucharest roadway system developed for much of the 20th century, the assumption was that people would travel by public transit. And so fast forward into our present era, there's this roadway system designed to accommodate some 200,000 cars, and there's something like 1.2 million cars trying to circulate through it. And so, you know, if you've ever been to Bucharest, getting around town can be a hair-raising experience, but parking your car is, you know, equally impossible. There's some 1 million illegally parked cars in Bucharest. There's just no parking spaces folded into the city. And as you might imagine, a million illegally parked cars causes a number of problems, both in terms of, like, you know, pedestrians and just trying to walk around the city. You find yourself trying to walk around these illegally parked cars, and pedestrians end up getting hit. So the number of traffic fatalities in Bucharest is quite high. Aesthetically, you have a lot of squares and side roads that are just overrun with illegally parked cars rather than being used for some other purpose. And so as a kind of fix, the municipality wanted to develop a series of underground parking garages. And they certainly invested in a couple, an initial two or three, and a lot of money was put into them. They're managed quite nicely. And the assumption was that all of these people would, you know, eventually have spaces to park their cars. These underground garages were just a drop in a bucket, but at least they would be getting the process started of providing parking. And lo and behold, absolutely, you know, these garages are operating at like a third to half capacity. People much prefer to park illegally for free rather than to pay for legal parking. And so, you know, again, the book is organized around a string of case studies that want to move across the city to see how the underground is taking shape, both with its excitement and its pitfalls. And underground parking, you know, proved to be a real pitfall. You know, it became obvious that most Bucharestians can't be sold on the idea of parking as a kind of middle-class experience or luxury experience or as a kind of identity. The ease of illegal parking and, you know, the high likelihood of not being fined for parking illegally certainly didn't compel anyone or persuade anyone to use these garages. And so while something like over a dozen were supposed to be developed, I think only three were built in the end.
And another pitfall of building parking garages is also that of building new high-rises. So if I have a house and my next-door neighbor starts to build a high-rise with foundations that go down 30 meters, what implications does that have for me?
Sure, 100%. And so, you know, as I'm trying to trace the development of the underground, I started working a lot with architects and civil engineers. And what I was told right off the cuff was that the socialist era built very different kinds of buildings. The kinds of buildings that are taking shape today are the kind of classic glass and steel office towers. They're extending much higher than construction did in the socialist era. And in order to support that height and to support the weight of those buildings, they're also developing significantly lower. And so, as you say, there are buildings taking shape that have foundations that go 30, 40, 50 meters underground. Some of these residential or office towers might have five basement levels to them. Like, they're significantly deeper projects. And so, you know, here the turn towards the underground really interfaces with the city's kind of underlying geology. Bucharest is really soft, sandy soils. It shifts pretty easily. And with any kind of development project that's going to dig down to those depths, there's a real challenge to maintaining the soil pressure so that adjacent buildings don't slide or crack during the construction process. And so, yeah, I was really interested in the extension of the city, the building new spaces that are going down further than the city traditionally has before, and thinking about how the responsibility for that depth and the benefits of that depth play out. And so, these office and residential projects, they're really good at structuring the benefits within the project site itself, like revenue is going to go into the building and into the building's investors. But lo and behold, if there are any errors in calculation as the building's taking shape and there are soil shifts, it can lead to the cracking of neighboring buildings. It can lead to roads buckling. It can have all kinds of problems that'll reverberate outward into the wider city.
So the moral of the story is don't build on sand.
Yeah, well, I want to be really clear here, because when I was talking a lot with architects and engineers in Bucharest, they were really worried that this story was going to be painted as them not being good at their profession, and they were always very clear that any kind of incident that I could point to in Romanian newspapers, they could point to things that had happened in my own home country, whether it was New York or Chicago, or moments where, developmental ambitions led to pitfalls. But certainly, the sandy soil isn't helping, and, life would be easier if the bedrock was closer to the surface of the city. But Bucharest poses its challenges.
Mm. One of the other challenges, just to come back to the metro where we started, is that no one seems to like riding on the metro. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. One particularly famous attempt to improve that was the Digital Public Library, which isn't really public and it's not really a library. What does the Digital Public Library project tell us about who companies think the middle classes are and what they want when they're underground?
For sure, 100%. And, again, to take a step back and try to think about some of the book's broader commitments, I mean, as whether it's the municipality, city planners, whether it's private developers, whether it's entrepreneurs or business people who are trying to reimagine the underground, the kinds of activities that could happen there, but also the kinds of people that would be invited to turn towards the underground. The question of gentrifying the underground really hinged on matters of aesthetics. If you think about the traditional underground, it's sewers, it's crypts, it's cellars, it's kind of a ghoulish place to be. And so trying to convince a larger swath of the population to go underground, it really hinged on aestheticizing the underground. It's absolutely about Edison light bulbs and subway tile and trying to make the underground into a really stylized experience. And so remind me, Roland, what was the question?
The Digital Public Library.
Yeah. So the Digital Public Library folds into this quite nicely. And so, in a moment where the municipality is interested in tripling the size of the metro system's track and doubling the number of stations and trying to encourage people to get out of their cars and into the metro, the aesthetics of the existing metro system was, identified as a real sticking point. The Bucharest Metro runs wonderfully efficiently. It's good at getting you across town. You're going to get across town much quicker on the metro than you will in your car. But by and large, people just like in survey data, people really did not appreciate the way it looked. They didn't appreciate the way it felt. The kinds of riders that own their own car would rather sit in their own car with its relative comforts than be in kind of a dark, dingy metro station. And then, here comes Vodafone with an idea for a really large scale advertisement project called the Digital Public Library. And it's going to cover a huge swath of Piazza Vittoria and turn it into this really, gorgeous looking library. And so there was a lot of excitement when the Digital Public Library unfolded. It was, described in the press and, among users as being beautiful or stunning or certainly an improvement from the yellowing subway tile beneath it. And I think about the public library as an opportunity for again, thinking about how the project of getting more and more people to go underground. And so I was interested in, you know, the act of reading as the core of this particular campaign. And I also became really interested in the sort of books that people were invited to check out of this public library. So maybe again, to take a step back, this digital public library, it offered some, I don't know, 500 book titles, and any Metro writer on any device could scan a QR code of a book title they were interested in, and they would get a teaser chapter, like the first chapter of a book. And then you could read it on your commute. And if you wanted to, you could download for payment the rest of the book and read it on your own time or anywhere that you liked. And so I was really interested in, you know, the kinds of authors that the digital public library was putting forward. It certainly wasn't light reading or casual reading. It was definitely like, you know, Franz Kafka and Immanuel Kant, which I don't know many people who want to read that kind of density on a crowded metro car, but I definitely applaud those kinds of writers and find inspiration in them. But yeah, I was interested in the act of reading, the kind of very hefty, you know, proper reading that was being put forward, and the kinds of, I think, broader ambition of cultivating a kind of underground where the university educated or an educated class feels as though they belong, like this is the space for them. So for me, I saw the digital public library as a real intervention in reimagining who the underground is for and who the ridership should or ought to be.
That some of your case studies are happier and some are more depressing than others. But one of the ones that I found really depressing was the one on underground bomb shelters. And sure. The city's full of them, but it doesn't sound like a lot of them are fit for purpose. What does these bomb shelters tell us about whose lives are considered important and whose are not?
Right. So, you know, a particularity of Bucharest, most every public building is going to have, by law, required a bomb shelter. And this law was put in place, you know, around World War II, and it has never been repealed. So, you know, any office tower or residential tower that's built, any library, any school, bank, any major public building is going to be required to have a bomb shelter on the lowest basement level of the structure. And these shelters come at considerable cost. Again, to speak to the architects who build them, the engineers who design them, you know, these bomb shelters can cost, you know, per square meter five times as much as the above ground extensions of the building. So they're really significant investments. And of course, you know, they're not comprehensive. The city roughly has space for 1 million people in its civil protection shelters and its bomb shelters. And, you know, the city's population is north of 2 million. And there's a very, you know, distinctive geography for these bomb shelters. Sure, they can be found all over town. But lo and behold, in the sites where there is more development or more investment, you're going to find more bomb shelters. And in places where there are fewer, newer developments, you're going to find less. And so perhaps predictably, the wealthier parts of town are pretty well covered as far as bomb shelters go, while the poorer parts of town are left exposed. And so for me, I mean, if we table the, you know, the imagined utility of any of these shelters, you know, I was really struck about with the amount of money, effort, and time that goes into making them, and then how much of the population is laid bare. Like, only certain people are being covered. And this became a really interesting way for me of thinking about incorporation in the city and who's fully incorporated and who's partially incorporated. And so I was very much interested in that. The other part of the story is that a lot of the socialist era housing blocks do have bomb shelters in their basements, but they're being used as storage or they've been allowed to flood, and so they're really non-functional. And so the onus is on the residents of the building themselves to invest the money to get them back into proper shape. Which can be, you know, a high financial burden for a number of families and a number of people. And if we begin to think about the practical utility of any bomb shelter, I think a lot of families are choosing to put their money elsewhere rather than investing in this kind of collective resource. And so, you know, even a number of people who might have access to these bomb shelters, it's almost in name only, which is another way for me of thinking about inequalities of inclusion in the way that certain people are better incorporated into the city rather than others.
And when I first looked at the title page to this, the contents page to this book, you got bomb shelters and parking garages and nightclubs and McDonald's. And it was hard to see what they all had in common apart from the fact that they're underground. But you say they're all part of a single story about what's happening to the city. What is that story?
Yeah, you know, so again, to take a step back, this book is really interested in the way people are turning towards the underground. And so it's a loosely coordinated effort between city planners who are looking to the underground to solve many of the city's problems, private developers who are turning to the underground as a place to extend their developments. You have entrepreneurs who are, you know, turning to their basements and cellars as sites to find new revenue. And across these three kinds of actors, there's a very clear, for me, story to be told about the way that the modern underground is being imagined, who it's for, and the purposes that it serves. And as I moved across the city's underground, the consistent thread that ties it for me is the idea that it's for this imagined middle class. And so, you know, I see across the city a new aesthetics of inequality that is taking shape vertically. One in which, you know, if the very poor have been cleared out of the city through various processes, the middle classes are being invited to turn towards the underground for a greater number of activities and for a greater amounts of their day, whether it's for commuting, for shopping, for working, for living, so on and so forth. And so I became really interested in the way that, ceilings and floors can divide a city just as walls and gates can divide a city. And so for me, the story, as we move across these kinds of spaces, I'm interested in the particularity of the underground, the way the underground is relating to the city above, the way that different kind of people are imagined as being funneled towards the underground or allowed to stay on top of the city, and for thinking about the projects of separation that the underground is making possible.
That's about all we have time for today, but thank you very much for talking us through that. And it's a really interesting book, which is definitely worth spending another few hours reading yourself.
I really appreciate it, Roland. Thanks so much for the invitation, and thanks so much for taking the time to read and talk with me about it. It's been a real pleasure.